KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. What would Seattle be like without all of its cultural touchstones? We're going to talk with Seattle Art Museum Director Kimberly Rorschach later this hour. Federal Drug Enforcement Agency officials raided several medical marijuana dispensaries in the Puget Sound region yesterday. The DEA did not release many details about the raids, but news outlets report among the dispensaries were Seattle Cross, Tacoma Cross, both previous raid targets. The DEA raids come 8 months after Washington state voters approved I-502, the initiative that legalized marijuana use and laid out terms to regulate its cultivation and sale. Marijuana sale and use is still against federal law, but state and federal officials have not agreed to a framework about which laws will take precedence in Washington state. Allison Holcomb is drug policy director for the ACLU of Washington. She helped write Initiative 502. I asked her if she had any more information about yesterday's raids.
We really don't have any information about what was underlying these particular raids. It does appear that one of the dispensaries reported to be involved in this raid was also a target of a DEA raid that occurred in 2011.
What I had heard, and perhaps it's speculation, is that when the DEA targeted some of these dispensaries in the past and perhaps yesterday, that it had to do with what they call criminal activity. In other words, selling the marijuana to people who perhaps were not certified medical users?
That's right. And those are the same kinds of allegations that I have seen and that have been recorded in federal search warrant affidavits in past years, including transactions of very large amounts of marijuana for very large amounts of cash.
How would this be different under Initiative 502?
Under Initiative 502, what will happen is that we will establish licensed stores that are selling limited quantities of marijuana, an ounce at a time, to any adult 21 years of age or older. Those businesses that are operating in this gray medical marijuana area that we have right now could opt to become licensed, regulated 502 stores. And essentially, the main difference is that we'd actually have some oversight regarding what marijuana is being sold to whom and under what conditions.
So the idea is that, as you mentioned, that gray area of what's criminal activity and what's not would be more clear-cut.
Exactly. We'd have more clarity. People living in neighborhoods where dispensaries have located now would know that with the 502 store, the Liquor Control Board would have had some oversight into deciding where the store was placed, and we would be sure that the people coming into the store were being carded to make sure they were 21 years of age and that the marijuana that was being sold to them had met quality standards.
At this point in time, the agency tasked with setting up all the regulations and issuing the licenses is still in the process of doing that. As that work is undergoing, state officials are still trying to get clarity from the federal government about how it will interact with Washington state and its officials. As far as I know, that clarification has yet to come.
That's right. The Department of Justice has been absolutely silent on their intended response to 502 stores when they are opened. And obviously, all of us are curious about these raids that happened yesterday. I think it's fair to say that if the federal government intends to begin cracking down on 502 stores when they open, they really ought to let Washington citizens know this. We passed this law with a significant majority last year. We're going to have a very tight regulatory system in place next month, according to the Liquor Control Board's timeline. And folks that want to apply for these licenses need to know whether or not they'll be targeted for federal arrest and indictment.
Do you have any idea why the federal government has yet to talk about this with state officials in any meaningful way?
Well, you know, up to this point, my take on that has been that they've been waiting to see what the market will actually look like. Our Liquor Control Board is, in essence, putting meat on the bones of Initiative 502 and really sort of giving some concrete shape to what Washington's recreational marijuana market could look like. Other considerations may be that they'd rather not have to weigh in at all, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly puts license applicants in an uncertain place.
You mentioned that observers were kind of curious about yesterday's raids. Reporters were curious as well, because it seems like it indicates something, at least about the DEA's attitudes, doesn't it?
Well, I think we've certainly heard from the DEA that they don't believe that marijuana is medicine. And furthermore, I think probably they would agree that marijuana should stay illegal, although I think that the agency is careful to keep its talking points to enforcement of the law rather than creation or amendment of the law. But, you know, we do have to remember that in the past, the evidence that has come to light has indicated at least that folks that were targeted by the DEA were operating well outside both the letter and the spirit of state marijuana laws.
And just a last question I have has to do with the relationship between the DEA and the Justice Department. I am assuming, perhaps incorrectly, that the DEA is under the jurisdiction of the Justice Department, correct?
That is correct.
So should the Justice Department issue something more definitive, the DEA would not be able to act like this?
That's correct. It's a little bit dicey in the sense that what we've seen in the context of medical marijuana is that the Department of Justice can't change federal law. It has to enforce federal law, but it does have the discretion to determine policy as to how federal law enforcement resources are to be deployed. So what we could expect to see from the department with respect to 502 is a statement of policy that might be similar to the memorandums that was issued in 2009 regarding medical marijuana, that in essence, law enforcement resources should not be focused on targeting individuals in compliance with state marijuana laws. Now, could a rogue DEA officer decide that, well, the law is still the law? Sure, and then we'd be in a very awkward position. But I think by and large, what we've seen is the agencies do follow orders from their chief. In this case, that chief is Attorney General Eric Holder.
Allison Holcomb is Drug Policy Director for the ACLU of Washington. She helped write Initiative 502. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Minutes past 9 o'clock. A look at the role of language on stage and in life in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
I'm bringing Facebook back.
Tech-savvy Vietnamese Americans are helping bloggers in Vietnam who face a government crackdown.
The security officer watch me and follow me everywhere I go.
The Vietnamese immigrants provide tips on evading government snoops.
Nobody will know that it is me looking at information on the web.
Helping bloggers in Vietnam stay connected on PRI's The World.
You'll hear that later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m. 70 degrees at the moment in Seattle with sun, expecting to reach 82 this afternoon. Tomorrow, a lot like today, few morning clouds maybe, and then mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 80. It's 9:15. Some thoughts on the intangible value of a city's art collection and other cultural assets 25 minutes from now.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Language is an orderly system. It's useful for communicating ideas and intentions between two or more people or two or more beings. But in Madeline George's play, Precious Little, language is a conduit for emotions, for memory, and for longing. Seattle's Annex Theater opens a production of Precious Little next week, and in the studio today we have director Catherine Karas along with actors Taryn Pierce and Sarah Papineau. Thanks all of you for coming in so early in the morning. Catherine, it's hard to describe this play. It operates on several different levels, but the heart of it is a character called Brody, so maybe we should just talk about her.
Yes, Brody is a professor of linguistics, and she is single, a single lesbian, and she is looking to be pregnant for the first time, and she is pregnant, and this play kind of charts her journey through her pregnancy and the difficulty that arises with it, and So it's a very dreamlike play. You said it operates on many different levels, and it really does. We're dealing with her relationship with her grad student, Dre, which we're going to see in a minute. We're dealing with her research of a dying language and dealing with extracting information from another character, and her relationship with a gorilla at the zoo, which is one of those elements that sounds so goofy, but it's a very poetic element to the play, which I think is very beautiful.
So set up the scene that we're going to hear, or we're going to hear a portion of a scene.
Yes. So in this scene, Brody and Dre are hanging out in Brody's office. They've been making out, talking, connecting. And here Dre is going to ask Brody out on a date.
And Taryn Pierce is Dre. Sarah Papineau is Brody.
Hey, I was thinking we should go out and do something together in the world.
Why?
Because it's a thing human beings do for pleasure called socializing.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Not dumb socializing, obviously, not dinner and a movie. I was thinking, like, what is something super rigorous and strange that would actually appeal to her arcane sensibilities?
And you came up with?
The zoo. Want to come with me to the zoo?
Not really.
Come on. It's pay what you want day at the zoo on Friday. I'm going. You should come.
That's what you came up with? The zoo?
Yes, because zoos rule.
I'm sorry. I'm not much of an animal person.
Yeah, you're cold-hearted.
I am not. I just feel about zoos the way I feel about mental hospitals. All those sad faces locked up in the rooms, all the bony fingers clutching the bars.
Okay, it's nothing like that. We have a prize-winning zoo in this town. It's totally innovative and cruelty-free and accurate about reproducing natural habitats. And I was specifically thinking you should come with me on Friday because they just got this new talking ape.
No such thing.
It's real. I read about it in the Post. They got it from some defunded language acquisition study in Arizona. Apparently it knows like 30 words.
My TiVo knows 30 words. That doesn't mean it talks.
Okay, but
you know how I feel about those studies. The NSF can barely be bothered to support the preservation of languages we're about to lose forever, but they'll happily dole out millions to a bunch of ponytailed SeaWorld trainers teaching pidgin English to monkeys. I refuse to be party to that crap. I'm not going all the way up to the zoo to stare at some government-funded circus act.
Fine. I just thought you might like to meet somewhere in public for once. Do something else besides screw and transcribe.
Sarah Papineau played Brody. Taryn Pierce played Dre in that scene from Madeline George's play Precious Little. And I think Sarah only plays the one character. Brody. Taryn plays many characters in this play. You have three actors, right, Catherine?
Yes, it's three actresses. And a really interesting part of this play is the fact that only Brody is static, and then the other two women play between three and five, maybe more, characters. It's kind of ambiguous in one case. It's a real wonderful acting challenge for the younger and the older woman in the play.
And a directing challenge?
Yeah. We've been looking for kind of ways to get into each character so they're distinct but not cliche, you know, not leaning on stuff that's crutchy like that.
I had the privilege of actually reading the script. So it really, the idea of language, which you just heard in that scene, there's Sarah's character very upset about a communicating gorilla, that's not language. The character, Brody, is a linguist doing research on this dead Russian language, which is also interesting because the subject, the informant, as you call her, Sarah, your character calls her an informant, which is very disturbing. The resurrection of language in participating in this research resurrects something else in this woman. It resurrects the past. And then there's the third attitude, which is the future. There's the fetus, the baby that Brody is carrying, and her attempts to communicate with that baby or the idea of the baby.
Communication is a huge theme, and how it affects how we not just take in information but process it ourselves, and then how it comes back out. It's not the same. It's a game of telephone. And Mary Bailey is the other actress, and she's really great to work with. She plays
the gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
and the amount of communication that happens nonverbally, especially with her, is really kind of amazing. She's very talented.
Well, you know, as theater people, you deal not just in showing us things, but actually language is sort of one of your stocks in trade. So in the course of working on this play, how does that strike you? How does what Madeline George has written into the script communicate with what you guys do for a living? Have you thought about it?
I wish I were as articulate as Madeline George or as Brody is.
We've been treating the script almost like Shakespeare. Honestly, it's
really
that specifically written. We treat it like every punctuation means something, and it's there deliberately. I mean, we were talking about italics and question marks yesterday, and we opened.
And that's not normal? You know, that's not a normal way to deal with a play?
With a new play, you know, honestly, sometimes the writing is not quite there already, and you're kind of working against the text, but this text is so beautifully crafted and so beautifully thought out. You know, each different character speaks in such a specific way. She's just made it really easy on us, honestly, because it's all there in the text.
The last thing that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about was the fact that the four of you immersed in working on this are all women, and this is a play about women and mothers and daughters. And
yes.
I believe that the ape is female, even though
yes,
she's
she
often called he in the script.
We talked about that. That was a mistake on the part of the characters. Yeah.
Not
the playwright.
Not the playwright.
Yeah.
And so how often does women's crafted work featuring all female characters come around in theater?
Not often enough. I think pretty much all of Annex agrees. We choose plays from an open submission process. So we get plays from everywhere. We don't on purpose choose plays by women or directed by women. But this season, we're presenting three plays by women, and all of the directors on the main stage are women. It's kind of amazing and incredible. And all of my designers, except for one, just happen to be women. It's a really great thing, because we're underrepresented still. Like, and just having the chance to play roles like this for the actors, I'm sure is awesome, because they don't come around often. You're stuck in the box of the wife or the girlfriend, or, you know, kind of bouncing off of the male characters.
And these are very strong characters and strong people. And it is great to see that.
We've been talking with three of the four members of the sort of main artistic team of Annex Theater's upcoming production of Precious Little. The play is by Madeline George. Sarah Papineau plays Brody, who is a 42-year-old pregnant lesbian academic linguist who's at the center of the play. Taryn Pierce takes on numerous roles. We heard her in a scene where she plays Dre, Brody's graduate student, but she has the challenge of juggling hats and characters, and it's all corralled by the director, Catherine Karras, who's with us as well. The play opens August 2nd. Thanks so much, the three of you, for being with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:25. Well, as you may have heard, Boeing's been having some highly publicized problems lately. How has all that been affecting Boeing's bottom line? Has it been affecting Boeing's bottom line? We'll find out in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
George Krimsky was an American reporter in Moscow, back in the days when it wasn't that unusual to have Stalin's daughter meet you on a windy winter beach to pass a message to her son.
Where she told me that she loved him dearly, she wanted him to know that, and she handed me a letter to give to him.
Coming up on the story, back to the day when spies were spies.
This afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW's second program service, KUOW 2.
Hi, this is Jack Spear with NPR News. You've heard us say it many times, and it's still true. You are the public in public radio. Everything you hear on KUOW is only possible with your support. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. And thank you.
71 degrees in Seattle under a clear blue sky. Forecast calls for sun all day with a high of 82. 927, I'm Bernard Ouellette. There are two open seats on the Seattle School Board and six folks in the running. KUOW's Ann Dornfeld will tell us about the candidates in 35 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Boeing's been in the news quite a bit lately, and it's not necessarily a good thing. Although company profits are up right now, Boeing airplanes have crashed, caught fire, and seemingly malfunctioned with regularity. Investigators are still looking into the recent 777 crash in San Francisco, as well as a more recent very rough landing in New York by a Southwest Airlines 737. Christopher Drew covers aerospace for the New York Times, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hey, Marcy, how are you?
I'm good. I just ticked off problems with three different Boeing airplanes, but I wanted to start with the most recent big-profile incident, which was the battery fire with a 787 at London's Heathrow Airport. It was an idled airplane. Can you explain exactly what happened?
Well, from what the investigators have said, it seems that an emergency locator transmitter, which is a little device in the tail of the plane, so if it had a crash, it could send out a signal so people could find the plane. It's got its own little battery, and the investigators think that somebody, either when they made that device or doing maintenance on it, closed a little cap on that battery inside this device and pinched one of the wires, and that somehow it erupted into a short that caused this fire.
So that's operator error, in other words.
Seems to be the manufacturer or operator, but it doesn't seem to be anything having to do with any of the new systems on the 787.
So it's unrelated to the spate of battery fires and malfunctions in the lithium-ion battery that grounded the fleet last year?
Exactly. And interestingly, it is a different kind of lithium battery, and the volatility of the lithium may have been at play, but this is a much more conventional kind. They use it in fire alarms and whatever. And, you know, everybody was cringing as soon as this happened because it seemed like, another problem with this innovative new plane. And but in some ways, once they found this sort of mundane cause, and these devices are on all kind of other planes, not just the 787, it sort of reminded you of that moment in Casablanca, you know, when Rick says to Ilsa, of all the gin joints in the world, why do you walk into mine?
Well, something like that. Or you wonder if there's some little black cloud that hovers over the 787.
Right. There seems to be some kind of early curse.
Yes, there does. In the meantime, that's the 787. The 777, the 777 that crashed in San Francisco, is still the cause of that crash is still being investigated. And it seems that what we're hearing leads more to the possibility that it was an operator error in that case as well.
I think so. What's come out is the Korean pilots. They were all experienced pilots. There were three in the cockpit, but the one who was at the controls only had 43 hours on the 777 and it was a clear day. And one of the problems was that an electronic system that helped at the airport that helps guide the plane to the right spot on the runway was down due to construction. So they had to make a manual landing, and you just get the impression that the more experienced pilots were letting the less experienced one with the plane practice his landing, and he came in short.
I heard that two passengers had planned to file, if not already have filed, a lawsuit against Boeing.
Well, so far, and it makes sense because everybody sues the deep pockets, right? But so far in covering it, there's not been anything that's come out about problems with the plane. One of the pilots apparently said in an interview with investigators that they thought they, a part of it that was sort of like a cruise control on your car that they had set and that it hadn't maintained the speed. But Deborah Hirschman, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, said immediately that that didn't appear to be a problem mechanically. And even if it had, it's up to the pilots to notice it. I mean, if you're going 70 down the highway and you set the cruise control and suddenly you find you're drifting down to 60, you know, you should notice that.
Indeed, one hopes you would. Christopher Drew covers aerospace for the New York Times. We're talking about Boeing in the news. Most recently, a Southwest Airlines 737 had what some people call a crash, some people call a rough landing at LaGuardia Airport, I believe it was, in New York, where the plane skidded several tens of thousands of feet upon landing, and it was a nose cone problem?
Well, the landing gear, the wheel under the nose crumpled on impact when it hit the runway. So at least now we're getting to something that is a mechanical failure out of these recent incidents, although this could also just be maintenance on Southwest part, because the plane, I think, was built in 1999. And while Southwest has a good record and they have a good maintenance program, they do tend to fly their planes a lot more than other airlines, because they're making a lot of these short hop flights and they use their planes a lot. Again, they usually maintain them pretty well, but maybe somebody missed something here.
In the meantime, we've just laid out things that have happened within the last 2 months. Boeing's profits are up by about 13% last I saw, and I wondered how that is possible given this spate of nasty news.
Yeah, no, it's true. It you look at it, and the one previous thing which you mentioned before, the lithium-ion batteries in
right.
the Dreamliner, that was something that, you know, was Boeing's fault, because they went to this new system, this new type of battery that was more lightweight and produced more energy, and they had done all these studies showing that there was like a 1 in 10 million chance of a smoke or fire problem. And then in the first 50,000 hours of flying these planes, there were two incidents. So they clearly miscalculated on that. But they came up with a fix, which, you know, doesn't seem very elegant, but it seems workable. And the reason their stock's been going up is because Wall Street and investors feel like after years and years of delays and problems with these 787s, you know, they now are finally delivering them to the airlines in increasing numbers. They're going to deliver 60 of them this year. And so that's bringing in lots of revenue, lots of cash to Boeing. And you put that on top of all the money, large profits they make on the 737s and the 777s, and the fact that from the Middle East to Asia, there's this huge demand for airplanes projected in the future, and the U.S. and European airlines need newer planes, more fuel-efficient planes, too. You know, they could ride a pretty good boom for the next decade or two.
One of the things that surprised me was that the main battery problems and the subsequent grounding of the 787 fleet worldwide, despite the fact that Boeing came up with a fix, it surprises me that passengers haven't been more leery about getting on these airplanes. And in fact, there have been a couple of recent problems with a London to Dallas, Texas run, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. There have been various glitches of fuel pump warnings and other kind of electrical panel warnings. Boeing says they're similar to the glitches they've experienced in the early months of early year or two of operation on other new planes. But the passenger question is a really interesting one, because whenever I ask any aviation experts about that, they basically say the history of this is that passengers just don't either pay attention, or they don't care, or, you know, they feel kind of like they're at the mercy of the airline system. They need to go somewhere, and they need to go at a certain day and time, and this is a plane that's flying, because people say even back in the day of the old DC-10s, when they had horrible problems, people didn't stop flying them in any big numbers.
How has at least the news about problems with Boeing affected Airbus, its main competitor?
Well, it's interesting. They have tried to be, they've alternated between trying to be low-key and understanding and then taking broad shots at Boeing. Their sales director said recently with the latest problems at Heathrow that, you know, Boeing had clearly rushed out this plane, it wasn't ready, whatever. And but the main thing is that, you know, Boeing, when it got into the 787 and its innovations with half the weight of the plane is in lightweight carbon composites and the 20% fuel savings and the new batteries and the new electric system that helps save fuel and whatnot, Boeing thought it would be a decade ahead of Airbus in adopting all these things. And Boeing squandered a lot of time. And so Airbus has had some difficulties with this, too, because all these technologies are difficult. But Airbus, you know, sees itself on the one hand as being able to catch up on some of the technologies a little more quickly, but it also can't get too haughty about that because Boeing has always done better in sales of the bigger planes, and like the 777, and so it's going to remain a pretty heated competition, and they both know that the Chinese and Brazilians and Canadians and others are all trying to build better planes to start competing with them at some point. So it's going to get rougher over time.
Now, didn't Airbus at least do a flyover of its main competitor to a big Boeing jet at the air show?
Yeah, they did. The A350, which is coming along. So it's the one that's going to be about half made of these plastic composites as well. And it's sort of bigger than the 787 Dreamliner, but it's smaller than the 777, so it's going to kind of, well, it's going to have three different size models in there, but it's going to kind of compete with both of those Boeing planes, so the lines are going to get blurred, and you know, they all publish these, you know, $200 million list prices, but then there's all kind of deal-making with the airlines where maybe they only pay, you know, 60% of that for the plane or whatever. So it's a very competitive world, and there's all these high stakes and these massive investments. So I think it's just going to get more and more interesting, the competition between these companies.
Well, so you've got these two big guys. You mentioned that there are other countries that are looking to develop their own airplane manufacturing. Are there any credible competitors on the horizon?
Well, the Embraer, the Brazilian company's done a good job at, you know, in the smaller commuter kind of jet market, and Bombardier, a Canadian company, is coming out with a new plane with more carbon composite in that kind of smaller end of the market, and the Chinese are working on a plane to compete with the 737. And Airbus's A320, which is the same size. So it's going to take, you know, China's probably the most formidable in the long run because they have the money and they clearly will do whatever they need to, including hacking and stealing technology to try to catch up. But these are, you know, complicated, delicate, difficult things to master. So everybody sees the real competition from them, you know, to still be at least a decade away. But the other problem is that, you know, the market, the demand for planes, China is going to be a huge buyer of planes, and so they can give a boost to their own fledgling industry by buying their own planes, even if they aren't as good, to try to move along.
But it's interesting. It sounds like what you're saying at the bottom of all this is despite these headline stories about various Boeing airplane models, that it's still Boeing and Airbus that are kings of the air at this point.
They are, and that's why they keep trying to increase the production rates at Boeing on the 737s and the 777s, because they want to sell absolutely as many of them as they can while they are still kings of the road.
Thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Thank you.
Christopher Drew covers aerospace for the New York Times. This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Even before the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy, officials were looking around for assets they could sell to help pay down the city's massive debt. Among those assets, the collection of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Now that the bankruptcy papers are before a judge, Forbes magazine reports appraisers from Christie's Auction House have traveled to the Motor City to take a look at the DIA collection. And that collection includes everything from a beautiful mural by Mexican painter Diego Rivera to work by Van Gogh and Picasso to the original Howdy Doody puppet. Some observers believe the art and cultural artifacts in that museum are worth more than $2.5 billion. That's if auctioneers find buyers for it. But isn't art collections worth only measured in dollars? What intrinsic value does it have for citizens? And what would Seattle be like without the Calder Eagle at the Olympic Sculpture Park or the iconic Hammering Man downtown? Kimberly Rorschach is director of Seattle Art Museum, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Marcy.
First off, before we talk about Seattle, as far as I understand it, the Detroit collection is owned by the city of Detroit. Is that true for Seattle Art Museum's collection?
No, it is not true for Seattle Art Museum's collection, and it's not true for most museums in this country, although there may be a few others where the ownership is held by a city, but it is not true in Seattle.
So in the very unlikely case that the city of Seattle had to file for bankruptcy, SAM's assets could not be considered city assets?
Correct. As I understand it, I mean, they are not owned by the city of Seattle.
Who does own them?
Well, the Seattle Art Museum owns them as a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. You know, we're a private nonprofit, as I believe it's called, but a nonprofit corporation, you know, chartered according to certain pretty strict rules about what a nonprofit organization is, you know, having to do with tax-exempt status and ability to receive tax-deductible donations, and it holds the things like works of art, which are very central to our mission, in trust for the public. And there are certain very significant responsibilities that come along with that in terms of how works of art have to be treated because, again, we're holding them in trust for the public, not as, you know, assets that we would deploy for any other reason than to benefit the public.
I know that there are people in the state of Michigan who argue that, the city of Detroit is holding the Detroit Institute of Arts collection in that same for the public as well, that it's not the same as a, I don't know, something else that you might sell, like a computer.
Yeah, and again, I'm not an attorney, and so, you know, I'm just giving you my opinion here. But if you read, there is an operating agreement exists between the city of Detroit and the what's called the Founders Society, a private nonprofit organized in Detroit to run the museum according to professional rules and standards. And this concept of holding the collection in public trust is absolutely embedded in that. You know, I think the question is whether the city could somehow void that operating agreement. And again, I'm not an attorney.
Right.
But it really is going to turn on how powerful is this concept of the public trust and the guardianship of these works of art, and that's where a state attorney general gets involved in deciding, you know, what can and can't be done, and it represents the public in terms of their interests in, you know, the things that are held in trust for them.
I mentioned that some appraisers have talked about the value of this collection at setting a dollar figure at $2.5 billion, but it got me to wondering how artworks are valued in monetary terms at all. Who comes up with these figures? And is it based on insurance? Is it based on what the market rate would be?
Well, yes. Again, we don't, you know, think or we don't talk about our collections in that way because they're not listed as assets on a balance sheet for us because we aren't permitted to sell them and use that money for anything other than enhancing our collection. So in that sense, you know, valuation is somewhat academic. On the other hand, we do have to think about risk management, and when something goes out on loan or when we borrow work from another museum, an insurance value has to be assigned, and, you know, we have to make sure that the proper coverages are in place should something happen. And we turn to those who are you know, actively involved in the art market every day, like the auction houses and the dealers, to help us identify those numbers. And, you know, yes, of course, they're based on transactions. They're based on buying and selling, and an art market exists, and private collectors exist, and they, you know, pay money for art, and that's how values are defined.
We're talking with Kimberly Rorschach, who is director of Seattle Art Museum, and you're a relative newcomer to Seattle and to SAM, but when you view the collection here, can you point, I mentioned the Calder Eagle and Hammering Man because those are out in public, but are there pieces of the collection that are, in other words, they're not things, they're more identifiers of a city, things that you would point to and say, this is absolutely iconic?
Yes, and again, as a newcomer, I'm still getting a feel for some of that, but certainly the Hammering Man, which I should point out is owned by the city. It was commissioned by the Seattle Art Commission, and although it stands in front of the museum, it is not owned by the Seattle Art Museum, but the Calder Eagle is owned by the Seattle Art Museum, as are, I believe, all the sculptures in the park. But my sense for us, there are a few iconic pieces, and interestingly, you know, some of them are outdoors. The Doho Sioux sort of cape made of dog tags, I think, is something that is very
yes.
much in people's minds. The Zai Guo Chang cars with the fireworks in our atrium in our forum down in the downtown museum. But I think for us, it's more the aggregate of the collections. You know, the wonderful Northwest Coast Native American collection, the wonderful traditional African collection, the wonderful collections of Asian art that we have, the very significant collections of modern and contemporary art that we have in our building, you know, rather than specific pieces mm-hmm. yet, perhaps, that are iconic treasures for the citizens of Seattle would be my take on that, although others who've lived here longer, you know, might respond to that somewhat differently.
Well, I love the Dohosa armor as well. I think that's a wonderful artwork, and I guess it's something that I visit when I go to the museum. And I was thinking about that in light of a news report that I saw over the weekend about the Detroit Institute of Arts, and they sent a reporter to the museum, and they found a museum goer who visits the DIA on a monthly basis, essentially to visit the art, to pay a visit to things that this man felt some kind of emotional connection with. And that got me to thinking about the intangible value. You know, we talked about dollar value, but it seems that cultural pieces have some other kind of value.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that's what we're in business to do. I mean, these things are our star-spangled banner, I would argue, you know, for a city or sometimes for a country even. I mean, these are very, very valuable. We, you know, these preserve our culture. They preserve our memories. You know, whether they were created here or elsewhere, but, you know, collected with great effort and brought together in a public institution to benefit our citizens and, you know, be of interest to our visitors and contribute to education. I mean, we're an important part of the education infrastructure in this city and in all cities around the country, and it's these works of art that are really the foundation of that and the iconic aspects of our collection. We're a younger museum, and you know, so it's not like the Mona Lisa in the Louvre here, but we have very important objects, very important collections, and we'll continue to build those. And you know, it's ultimately for the public to decide, I suppose, but you know, a great city needs a great museum. I would certainly argue, as a museum director, you won't be surprised to hear. And you know, to think about what it would mean and what it would represent if we did not have access to those very precious objects. Again, that because of the monetary value that they've accumulated, they're not things that people can very readily bring into their homes except in reproduction. And to be able to see them and experience them and get to know them and benefit from them emotionally and intellectually is critical in our society. I mean, those of us who you know, work every day to make those experiences available very profoundly believe.
Kim Rorschach, I know that you've been involved on a national level. You have worked in other museums, but you're also involved with your peers on a national level. What kind of conversation has the situation in Detroit generated among you?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, everyone is very, very distressed and wanting to be as supportive as possible to Graham Beal, the wonderful, heroic director of the Detroit Institute of Arts, who's worked so valiantly to, you know, preserve that institution and the collection. I mean, before this ever came along, the museum was in, you know, a pretty a challenging financial state, you know, again, because of the state of the city and the you know, many of the communities around it. But he led a political effort to get a millage passed, a tax passed to support the museum's operating expenses, and it passed very handily in Detroit and surrounding counties, a very resounding vote of confidence. Yes, we treasure this museum, and we want to all come together to provide resources for it to continue to exist, you know, even if we're not wealthy people, but the taxpayers of this area. And it was just amazing, the outpouring of support that he and that the museum received. So we're very distressed about this, trying to be supportive of him. There's a limited amount we can, as it were, do about this other than express our support, but we're watching events very carefully and you know, trying to see what there might be that we could do to help.
Even if officials allowed the city of Detroit to go ahead with, it is liquidation of the Detroit Institute of Arts collection, it doesn't seem like something that just turns over. It's not like selling a rug or a chair or anything like that. I mean, how many people can step up to buy these things?
Well, very few, but of course there's a lot of wealth that's been created, as we're aware, up at the top, and they need places to put that money. There are people who collect art and who, you know, are willing to pay very large sums of money for wonderful works, and there are some very wonderful rare works in the collection. So I think there's some things that would, you know, find buyers pretty easily, others not so much, and one, you know, you always have to think about timing and all that kind of thing. I don't even want to talk about it because
right.
I hope it's not going to happen, and I actually believe that it's not going to happen. I think the public trust issue will be compelling, but that's just my personal opinion. But there has always been, and there will always be, a market for great, great works of art. But it's not an easy thing to do, you're right, and it's not a quick thing to do.
Has anything like this ever happened before at a United States museum?
Well, I'm sure you read that article in the New York Times about the Fresno Museum,
right.
The Fresno Metropolitan Museum, so there's that. There was a very difficult moment for Brandeis University and the Rose Art Museum there some years ago. I happened to be an alum and someone who knows that institution very well and got very concerned and involved, but the university suffered dramatically in the financial downturn, in the economic downturn, and considered selling the collection of the museum, which is a great, great collection of post-war American work, and, you know, might in theory have brought in a great deal of money. But they were persuaded not to do that, not to be hasty about that. They were also persuaded that legally it would have been very, very difficult to do so. And, you know, the financial situation improved, and now, you know, everything's fine, and, you know, they have a wonderful collection that they can use to continue educating their students, as I was educated with it, and, you know, serving a broader public there in the Boston area. And, you know, once you let something like that go, it's gone forever, and you can never get it back.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about the very many places that you have been as a student, as a director, as a curator. And as you mentioned, you are a relative newcomer to your museum, to your museums. You have three sites that you oversee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have a touchstone piece of art in one of those buildings or outdoors at the Sculpture Park that's something that you are really connected to?
Well, I need more time to really have a deep answer to that. I mean, the Borofsky is certainly iconic for the Seattle Art Museum.
That's Hammering
Man. For a long time. The Calder is majestically beautiful in that site, and that means something to me emotionally. So those two stand out for me, as they do for so many other people. To me, it's more about building a collection and amazing gifts that have been made. And another work that is iconic for me here, although it's not currently on view, but it will be soon, is our Andy Warhol Elvis double portrait, mm-hmm. The silver Elvis Presley.
Right.
He's in my view, one of the greatest contemporary artists who set a course that's still important to so many. That's a major, fabulous, wonderful picture in the Seattle Art Museum's collection. So I would put that's a Mona Lisa to me in its way.
And I'm sure that everybody who's listening right now will go, but what about this one? And that's a great thing.
Others will have their favorites, and that's definitely a great thing too. There's always something to discover in any museum. When I go to New York, I love to visit the Holbeins at the Frick. I just like to go and see them, even if I have 5 extra minutes. Are those the most famous paintings for everyone at that museum? I don't know, but for me, they're very meaningful, and I just like to go and see them when I have a chance to do that. So everyone can develop their own. I think that's the beauty of our collection and of many, many museum collections in our country.
Kimberly Rorschach is Ilsley Ball Nordstrom, director of the Seattle Art Museum. Sam, thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you, Marcy.
The fate of the Detroit Institute of Art collection is still to be decided. Appraisers from Christie's Auction House reportedly traveled to Detroit this week to talk with museum officials. This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. And now, the sound of the day. Listeners David and Pasha sent us that. It is an improvisational solo performed by their dog Brio on his squeaky toy. You hear how that goes. Brio plays the squeaky toy from time to time, and David and Pasha refer to him as the John Coltrane of squeaky toys.
Do they say what shape this squeaky toy is? Now I'm curious.
Well,
a hot dog, a monkey?
You can see a picture of Brio. This is a Bernese Mountain Dog, and it's on our Facebook page, which is, I'm not sure if it's on the KUOW Facebook page or the Weekday Facebook page. I think Weekday on KUOW, and check it out, and you can friend us there as well. I like that. You can hear it has a little rhythm, right? A little squeaky rhythm. It's pretty cool.
That dog's got something.
Yeah, really. Send that Brio out to work. What interesting sounds do you hear in the world around you? Record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email the audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. Susan Orlean was in our studios a few months ago. We're going to bring back that beautiful interview for you to listen to. Great writer. We're also going to talk with KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld about the Seattle School Board election. You're going to see 6 candidates in some parts of the city of Seattle.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. The latest on that deadly train crash in Spain in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
They say money can't buy happiness, but can smarter spending make you happier? Elizabeth Dunn is a psychology professor who's been looking into this, and she says yes. She'll tell you the 5 principles.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.